morning, everybody. This is the scheduled meeting for the Lander and County of Legislature to discuss legislation pending before us. What we intend to do is take a break in just a moment and have all those people in the audience who wish to testify come up and give your name, where you live, and who you represent for the record. This will be the witness stand down here. We're going to be running all day today if need be, all day tomorrow if need be. We want to make sure that everybody who has anything to say on the bill is heard. The gentleman on my left is Senator Pete Dillon from Sitka. My name is Bob Zicker. I'm from Ketchikan. The gentleman over here, the great Coach John, please stand up. He's John Elliott, the executive director of the Legislative Affairs Agency. We are a three-man committee, the third member being Anchorage's Laura Coleman, who is unable to attend because of illness in his family. We may or may not have young Russell Lee as witness later on today. So with that, if you have anything to say, and we want to hear everybody, you will give your name to Mr. Elliott right now, and then we'll get one. Rapper John. Good morning. there in the front row right here, you can come up and get one. It'll make it probably a lot easier and hopefully more enjoyable for people who actually didn't have a copy. All right, let me bring you up to date as to what's happened with the uniform residential landlord in town.
Sir, could you speak up a little? I can't hear you.
All right, sir, how about coming over here? Are you reading me all right in the back of the room? I can't. How about this? Better? Okay. Wave to me if I lose you or... Anyhow, the original legislation was promulgated by the uniform commissioners. They call it the Uniform Residential Landlord and Tenant Act. The original bill was Senate Bill 54, introduced by the administration. That was introduced in the Senate. It came to me as the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and it still reposes happily in my committee. The counterpart measure was introduced by some individual legislators, most of them were from Anchorage. That was House Bill 226. In one of its refined forms, that's what we're working with today. Now, I think it's safe enough to say, and I speak for myself only, not for my committee members, but both of the original versions, they may have been Model Acts for New York City or wherever, but they were not Model Acts for the state of Alaska. And the House version, which is before us today, this is committee substitute for House Bill 226 amended. I think the consensus is that even though the original bills were atrocious, this bill is a better bill. But we haven't seen the end of the road yet, and that's why we're here. When the House passed its version and sent it over to the Senate, the people on my committee and Senator Bailen is one of them, we felt that it was a bill of such major importance that the people of the state of Alaska should have the opportunity to familiarize themselves with it, to study it, to come to public meetings, to be heard, in the hope that eventually my committee and this committee will be able to bring forth a bill which essentially will be fair to all. Now, there is no way that this committee or any other committee that I know of can draw a bill which everybody will admire. But what we want to do, with all possible, is to be fair to everybody. Now, if there are complaints that the bill should have been on the books a long time ago, I have to take the blame. As I said, it's much too important to do it hastily. And if you're going to do it all, you might as well do it as well as you can. The committee has been in Juneau, in Sitka, just spent 2 days in Fairbanks, and as I told you earlier, we'll be here all day today, all day tomorrow, and MDP will continue tomorrow evening. Thereafter, this committee will finalize a report to the legislature because we have been directed to do that, and hopefully, working with the House Commerce Committee, on which Mr. Meekins serves, we'll be able to present a joint work product to the legislature, which will make sense and be fair. Also, I don't want anybody to get the idea that the bill is ready to be rushed out on the House floor or the Senate floor, because it won't work that way. Anybody who is interested to get a copy of the final work product, if you'll again leave your name and address to Mr. Elliott before you leave the room, and you'll have ample opportunity to make your views known by writing to us in June. I anticipate that should be late March or early April before we're ready to take final action. In connection with testifying, when you come forward, please bear in mind that we are not interested in the individual beefs of the landlord or of a tenant. I practice a lot of free law at these other hearings, and that's not the purpose of this meeting. The purpose of this meeting is to address yourself to the bill. Tell us what you like about it. Tell us what you don't like about it, and tell us how you feel the bill could be improved. But I don't want to hear from the disgruntled landlord who's got an open of a tenant, or the tenant who's complaining about how evilly treated he or she may be by his or her landlord. That is really not our purpose today. Over the centuries, I think the common law has generally favored the landlord. The original bill was introduced in both the House and the Senate, swung the pendulum again, in my opinion, not necessarily in the opinion of the law committee members, too much the other way. We're trying to find an area, this particular relationship, where we can have a mutuality of agreement. Okay, so with that, if there are no questions at this time from the audience, we can proceed with taking testimony. We prefer to do it in form, maybe certainly not in order. We'd like to conduct it on a give and take basis, so we'll just chat about the bill. I think the first witness who signed up is Dwight Bowden. Think about it.
Okay, I'm Dwight Bowden. I'm chairman of the Legislative Committee for the Alaska Landlord and Property Managers Association. And I did go to Juneau last year and testified before the Judiciary Committee in the Senate on Senate Bill 54. Since that time, of course, we've come out with the House Bill 226 and amended, and have been given an opportunity to study it and discuss it in various meetings through the year. The Alaska Landlord and Property Managers Association is composed of 130 landlords that are the majority of course are in the Anchorage area, but we do have members in other cities throughout the state. The number of units that these 130 landlords own or manage is 3,614 to date. We have, I think your remarks previously were correct in that this House Bill 226 that we have before us is a much better bill than originally proposed Senate Bill 54 or the House Bill 226. There are a few areas that we don't feel are fair. We still feel that it goes too far toward protecting the tenant to the detriment of the landlord, primarily due to the fact that although the bill does purport to treat the landlord and tenant equally before the court, the tenant is very difficult to locate when it's time to bring him to justice, and the landlord is always there. What I'd like to do is just go down through the bill and address myself to particular portions of it that I feel that we should.
And like when you do that, sir, would you refer specifically to page number and section of the
proposal? Okay, actually, I'll skip down to page 5, Article 2, line 5, under landlord obligations. This refers to security deposits, prepaid rent. The first paragraph A says, a landlord may not demand or receive prepaid rent and security, however denominated, in an amount or value in excess of 1 1/2 months periodic rent. Well, in the first place, this is a very poorly drafted. I don't think that this says what they intended for it to say. If I read it correctly, it does say that the landlord can't collect more than 1 1/2 months periodic rent at the time that he rents a unit. This would mean that the maximum security deposit in advance over and above the 1 month that rent that he gets ordinarily is the maximum security deposit that would be allowed. I don't think that the drafters of the bill intended that. As a matter of fact, 1 1/2 months rent in addition to 1 month's rent would be, I think, is the intent of the drafters of this bill. We don't feel that there should be any maximum amount of security deposit that can be asked, depending on the circumstances, and provided that it's not different from one tenant to the next. In other words, if it's under similar circumstances, there shouldn't be any discrimination between from one tenant to another. But we don't feel that there should be any, due to the varying circumstances and the wide area that's covered in Alaska, the wide variety of units that are covered by this bill, it's just too difficult to say what maximum amount of security deposit would be fair. Paragraph B, we are in favor of. It does call for the landlord to pay the security deposit back within no later than 14 days after termination of the tenancy, and to tell the tenant what, given the reasons and listing for any damages that might be deducted from that security deposit. We feel that that's fair. Paragraph C says, all monies paid to the landlord by the tenant as prepaid rent and security in a lease or rental agreement shall promptly be deposited by the landlord in a trust account in a bank, savings loan association, or licensed escrow agent, and the landlord shall provide to the tenant the terms and conditions under which the prepaid rent and security or portion of it may be withheld by the landlord. I fully realize the intent of the drafters of the bill when they wrote that paragraph, and I understand, I believe, the what they were intending to do by it. There are some landlords who withhold security deposits without justification, but this particular paragraph doesn't solve the problem. If you place that security deposit in the trust account, it's still under the control of the landlord, and there's no way in the world that you can set up a trust account that's under control of both the landlord and the tenant that I know of. So in effect, those landlords who withhold security deposits without justification will not be affected by this particular paragraph. And this will entail a great deal additional bookkeeping load and trouble, time and trouble on the landlord. So it doesn't solve the problem that it's designed to solve, and is an additional burden on the landlord. And it doesn't, I'll just end that right there. In paragraph D, if the landlord woefully fails to comply with paragraph B of this section, the tenant may recover an amount not to exceed 1.5 times the actual amount of damages and attorney's fees. We feel that this is probably an error of the drafters. We feel it should read, the tenant may recover an amount not to exceed 1.5 times the actual amount withheld in attorney's fees. The amount of damages, I think, would be subject to extensive litigation, and too difficult to determine what it might be. Page 6, line 21, landlord to supply possession of the dwelling unit. We had a great deal of discussion about this particular paragraph. There are some problems with it. It provides that the landlord shall deliver possession of the premises to a tenant if he has rented, and the circumstances under which this occurs, of course, is that a tenant gives notice that he's going to move on the first day of January, and the landlord rents the apartment to someone else to take occupancy at that time. And lo and behold, the first day of January, the new tenant wants to move in, and the old tenant hasn't moved out. So it's an impossibility for the landlord to provide that tenant, the prospective tenant, with that place that he is renting to him. Because we can't, under the present law or this law, we can't just move the old tenant out even though he's given notice. So we feel that that should just be omitted. I think it's a problem. We don't know the answer to it, but this isn't it. Let's get to page 11, line 3, article 4, under tenant remedies. In general, we don't disagree with this particular section, except that it does, just a moment. In the event of a breach, line 9, it does provide that the tenant can terminate the rental agreement not less than 20 days after it received notice if the breach is not remedied in 10 days. We feel that if the landlord is in good faith trying to remedy the breach at that during that period, that and it's there are many circumstances where it might be impossible for him to do so, then landlord should be given some leeway there. On page 15, line 9, article 5, under landlord remedies, we don't, there are many provisions of this bill that provide that the landlord is going to maintain the premises and for health and safety, to give the tenant a good place to live and maintain it just as any good businessman would do. And we feel that the tenant has the right to complain when these things are not done. We don't feel that the tenant has a right to complain if he hasn't paid his rent. So we feel that paragraph A should be deleted in its entirety and substituted, if tenant fails to pay rent within 3 days, all tenant rights will terminate. And then paragraph B, we feel should read, don't bother reading what it says, if tenant fails to pay rent within 3 days, after written notice by the landlord of non-payment and his intention to terminate the rental agreement if the rent is not paid within that period of time, the landlord may terminate the rental agreement and recover possession of the dwelling unit. Failure of the tenant to leave the premises on request of the landlord, the tenant shall be guilty of trespassing. Under, on page 17, line 7, landlord liens distinct for rent. This is abolished. Many times, it was the opinion of the of our association that the only worldly goods that some tenants have is his personal property and so forth in the dwelling. And it's unfair to the landlord to prohibit him from holding those personal possessions for non-payment of rent or property damage. So we felt that should be changed to landlord shall have a security interest or lien for non-payment of rent or property damage, personal possessions of the superintendent. Line 12, disposition of abandoned property. I think possibly this is a problem both to tenants and landlords, I think. I don't see how that you can define exactly what should be done. And many times, the property, personal possessions that are left when a unit is abandoned, it's rather difficult for the landlord to tell whether those actually possess value or not. The present law is, what's existing on the books under common law is extremely difficult for the landlord and doesn't do anything for the tenant. I think probably it's the present law is largely ignored by most landlords. We feel that this should read, except as otherwise agreed, if upon termination of a tenancy, including but not limited to a termination after expiration of a lease or about surrender or abandonment of the premises, a tenant has left personal property upon the premises, and the landlord reasonably believes that the tenant has abandoned this personal property, the landlord may dispose of it as the landlord sees fit.
That would greatly simplify things, wouldn't
it? Yes, it would. Well, if the if it is abandoned, then you know why should the landlord be responsible for maintaining and taking care of that property? Yes, that's our view. On page 19, line 12, recovery of possession. We feel that there's nothing wrong with that particular paragraph, except that add previous to that, while rent is current, a landlord may not recover or take possession of the dwelling unit by action or otherwise, etc. On page 20, line 23, retaliatory action. We wrestled with that one quite a long time. There was a divergence of opinion in our association on it. We did, though, in the end, decide that the only reasonable thing to do with that particular article, retaliatory action, was deleted in its entirety. That concludes
my question.
Mr. Brown, you and several others have testified that, regarding the section here on requiring trust connection. And to tell you the truth, I'm not too familiar with the banking business. Explain to me what the drawn-out procedure actually would be for a landlord under disability
agreement. I don't quite follow you on what you mean by drawn-out procedure. I can tell you what should be done if this bill, as it's now written, is to be followed. Is that what you're asking?
Right.
Okay. The landlord will maintain a separate bank account. The easiest way, of course, to do it would be to open a checking account. And this would be a separate checking account for security deposits only. Then this would be named a trust account. This is under the operation, sole control of the landlord. Security deposits that are collected will be deposited in that account, and when the tenant moves out and the premises are left in condition acceptable to the landlord for returning that security deposit, then a check would be written to the tenant for his security deposit or whatever amount might be withheld from that. For the large landlord, in my opinion, it isn't going to be as difficult and troublesome as it is for the small landlord. However, it is going to be additional bookkeeping, maintaining a separate bank account, reconciling those accounts at the end of each month. You have separate checks, you have additional filing. It's an additional work. On the small landlord, who probably places the rent in his personal checking account in any event, let's say the duplex or fourplex or sixplex, he probably doesn't even have a separate account for the rental business. So we're asking him to open an account with a $100, let's say, deposit, or a $200 deposit, or a $300 deposit, leaving that amount there indefinitely. And then at such time as the, and this of course would be subject to bank service charges, which would rapidly deplete that balance. Then this would be, this particular section would be virtually impossible to enforce. I don't know how you would control it. If the landlord chose to ignore that particular section, I don't know how you could enforce it without, I mean, it's going to be, it could be done just as anything could be done, but there's a, the legislature, I'm sure, is not going to give the money to the state police or the audit division of the revenue department or whatever it takes to go out and audit all of the landlord's trust accounts in the state of Alaska. Yes, I did.
Would you and the people you represent quite have any vast objection to doing the same thing with the bill before us, 2726, and you probably intended to anyhow?
Yes, we have intended to. It's just one of those things that we haven't gotten it done yet, but we do intend to. Give you our version. The way we feel that House Bill 226 should read.
And that would, I further assume, incorporate those things you touched upon today.
That's correct.
Okay, now, with reference to some of your comments, you know, you win some and you lose some. In both original bills, if you remember, in connection with security deposits, you had to keep a separate bank account, a separate trust account for each and every tenant. And I think we all agree with you that would be a terrible burden to impose.
That's correct.
The house came up with is a better deal than the one which you started with. I hope that we can do something more, but I don't see why it would pose any particular problem to have one trust account for all tenants, irrespective of the number of tenants, as long as you are authorized to commingle those funds. But as long as you have one ledger indicating that tenant A has so much there, tenant B has so much there, this is
it's not insurmountable, it's just an additional burden that we'd prefer not to have.
Right. Well, okay, now, we have learned the definition section of this bill needs some work. For example, there is no definition for abandoned property, what constitutes abandoned property. We also think we have to define the phrase where resulting in ordinary use. You know, break down what is that, how do we define that? So we're going to have to work on that. I also think the landlords are going to lose a battle on the restraint for rent provision. I respect your feelings and I think I understand them, but I think you're out of step with this day and age. We don't slam a padlock on the door anymore because the tenant has to pay rent. Again, that's my opinion, not necessarily the tenant's. In connection with the abandoned property, you are right. It is a the situation as it exists today is a very murky area of the law. As a lawyer, I know this. And there are other gray areas in the existing law. The statutes are all over, so if this bill does nothing else, at least it will recodify what we have and put it in a place where everybody can find it. And I think you're going to get a bill in one form or another. Maybe not to you, perhaps you don't know.
Okay.
My name is Mary Thu, and we have, my husband and I have 6 rental units. We've been landlords for almost 10 years now. And I have read the bill, and basically I would say I support Mr. Bowden's position on the changes in the bill. And I would like to emphasize our opinion, the need for a security deposit. It should be flexible because different people have different situations. If a family with 7 children and 5 dogs should want to rent an apartment, it is reasonable for a landlord to expect more security deposit than he would from a family of 2 people who go to work each day. Very often, the security deposit becomes rent when a tenant abandons the unit, which brings us to the definition of abandoned. It's a very precarious situation. A tenant has his rights. You know, he's rented it, but he hasn't paid his rent. He hasn't checked out, and the landlord is faced with the problem, shall I go and see what he has in there, see if he has gone and invade his privileges, or shall I just wait another month and see if he comes back? This can be very expensive and very frustrating. And I'm sure it would be irritating to a tenant if the landlord went in and packed up his few things that he left. Suppose it's a furnished apartment that he has even less to take out. And this is why the security deposit in some cases becomes rent. And a landlord should be able to make a determination as to when an apartment or a building has been abandoned. Because as it is now, usually there is at least a month's rent lost waiting to find out. And then sometimes there's cleanup work to be done. And then re-renting. It usually amounts to about 2 months of rent in one of the, just a good unit, not a pig pen. And these are the points that we would like to stress as one landlord to 6 tenants. Most of our tenants are very satisfactory, but there are occasions when one leaves. There is no one left to sue. There is no way that we can gain back any lost revenue or, as far as that goes, property. Sometimes the property goes with the tenant. And this is all that I had to say.
Okay, well, I believe your word was you want flexibility in determining the amount of the security deposit.
Yes.
And you gave us a good illustration, and I think maybe that suggestion does have some merit. We'll show it again to it has been suggested, not only in Fairbanks, but let me ask you a question about that, that we, in the final version of the bill, we exempt all landlords with four rental units or less. Now, of course, it wouldn't affect you since you've got six.
Unless we sold one.
Do you think if the bill is going to be enacted, it should be applicable to all landlords, irrespective of the number of rental units?
Sir, I don't think it should be exempted, because I think it's like the fair labor laws. They're time and a half on employers with more than four employees. The one who has the less than four employees gets away with things that are absolutely unreasonable. No, I think that if one is a landlord, he should have, well, it would clarify his position too. You would have to account to the Internal Revenue for it. It would be a separate business. One figures a separate form for it and reports his income differently. He may as well comply, I would think.
And you mentioned most of the time, you say, a lot of times, security deposits end up as rent.
Yes, sir.
Actually,
we have laws that take care of it. There's the 10-day notice if the rent isn't paid. Then you wait and get a court order, and then you have to, sometimes they have to be served. This is the other extreme to just picking up in the middle of the night and leaving. Now, if all tenants and all landlords did what they were supposed to do, we wouldn't have any of this trouble. But it doesn't work that way. I'm sure there are bad landlords too. Whole bunch of them. I didn't read it that way, sir. I read it as being a half a month's rent plus the month rent that you collect in advance. All rent is supposed to be prepaid.
Well, if that's right, would 1.5 times the rent be?
Not necessarily. Suppose you had a very, very nice apartment with very, very nice brand new furniture in it. This could all be picked up and moved out one night. One might need to get more, and I hear we're going to get all kinds of interesting problems we've never had before with the pipeline. But so it would depend on the amount of value that one had in the portable, especially the portable furnishings.
I see what you were talking about when you were saying that you must have definition of, must be able to make a determination of abandonment. I'm wondering if you had any ideas about how we can do that. I was thinking there is a section in the bill that states that, I don't know if this will be retained, but as it is now, a tenant receiving for more than, I think it is, 5 days must notify the landlord. There's been some suggestion that we make that 3 days, so that if a tenant is leaving more than 3 days, he must notify the landlord. And I was thinking that if that section is retained, we could make an addition somewhere that says that if the landlord is not notified and a tenant has left for more than 3 or 5 days, then the landlord can make a determination if, let's say, the rent is not paid.
If the rent is not paid after 5 days or 3 days, as the case may be, and the tenant has not contacted the landlord could assume that the unit had been abandoned. This would be quite satisfactory. It would take all of the worry out. All rent is prepaid usually, you know, unless the tenant is behind.
The way this thing was drawn,
I'm a landlord, and I'm a member of the Landlords Association down, and I agree with Mr. Bowden. We've all worked on that, on this bill, and looked over it quite thoroughly. A couple of things that I, in particular, want defined by this bill is what a tenant is and when he ceases to be a tenant. I feel that once he does not pay his rent and he does not make any contact with us, you know, if it's military, if his pay is messed up, I don't know a landlord in town who won't work along with their people. And it doesn't, you know, any tenant, if they will talk to us, why, we're in this business to try and make a living. It's not a tax dodge to us. This puts clothes on our kids' backs. So I want it defined exactly what the tenant is and when he ceases to be a tenant. Also, on evictions, I want to know exactly where I stand. I don't want to have to guess. I want to put out in very plain language what my rights are and what his rights are. Yes, yes. I don't want his belongings, quite frankly. I don't want to have to confiscate them or anything like this. On page 15, if the tenant fails, I thought on the bottom of it, it should say, if the tenant fails to pay rent within 3 days, his rights cease and the landlord has a right to recover the premises and go in and do whatever he has to do to re-rent them. Also, on securities, I don't think that putting the money in a trust account really is, I don't understand what the problem is, really, because we are obligated by law right now, within a certain length of time, to return that money to our tenants. And maybe it isn't done. If a landlord doesn't do it, why, he's subject to criminal law, I believe, if he doesn't do it. But, you know, we have to give the money back. And I don't think anyone really, or I don't, personally. I don't have any questions about it. When his termination is done on his rental unit, I inspect it and give his money back. And as far as for saying that the security should be 1.5 or 2 times what the rent is, if a landlord really gets out of line, he's not going to have a tenant. The person won't move in the first place. And as a note to you people, I've been in the rental business for about 11 years in Anchorage. And right now, I personally am still renting my units for the same price that I rented them for 3 years ago. And if I raise the rent, I won't have any tenants. Because there is a situation right now where there's more units than there are people to fill them. With the pipeline, maybe I'll be able to raise the rent enough so that the new assessments for streets and sewers that have been put on my unit, I'll be able to recover that. As it is now, I'm eating it. That's all I have to say.
We don't need that. And there will be one provision in the bill before, which I assume you would favor, and that is this. If you are, I'm assuming, an abundance of tenants, that's number one. But if you are putting any unusual expense, such as you just mentioned, assessments for street, sewer, and so on, you may then increase your rent proportionally.
Yes, I think we should. Yes.
If the great expense, for whatever reason, like if you go around to your tenants proportionally, you say, okay, whereas you were paying $175, this project cost me X number of dollars, therefore your rent is worth, it's going to be $200.
At which point now they'd move out.
Well, I'm not.
Yes, but I agree with you. It should. Yes, yes.
Mr. Goodman, I imagine that then before too long a time, you were probably spending time again with Mr. Bowden and actually giving us your viewpoint of what is a tenant and how eviction should be made.
Yes, yes. I think he mentioned that a tenant, I wrote it down. Page 26. It's on page 26. And it says a tenant means a person entitled under a rental agreement to occupy a dwelling unit to the exclusions of all others as long as he is current in his rents. That would, well, generally, yes, yes, as long as he's current. Yes, it is a short time, but then again, if you wait 10 days, why, it's just money out of my pocket. 3 days, it's still money out of my pocket. Well,
I'm Ralph Foster, and I, too, am a landlord. I represent or have some 35 units that I have an interest in. I cover a pretty fair cross-section of people, as my rentals run from $90 to $500. I feel that we do need some kind of legislation. But I think the legislation ought to be fair to the tenant and fair to the landlord. They should both be treated alike. And you asked a while ago about excluding the units, people with 1 to 4 units. I don't believe in this either. I think they should all be treated the same, the landlord, all landlords and all tenants. On the trust accounts, this, again, is a problem, probably, on a trust account for the deposits. Probably a problem for the small landlord, because putting money in a trust account requires a trip to the bank. Taking it out requires another trip to the bank. And if you're going to put it in a trust account, I'm not sure, but I don't believe they pay interest on it. And in the old bill, I know there was something about the landlord had to pay the tenant interest. perhaps a minimum, say a landlord that had a security deposits of over $1,000 should put them in a trust account. Maybe that would be a solution. 500 or 2,000, or set a minimum figure of a security account dollars. One other thing is the IRS requires that you keep an account of your security deposits. So there is a bookkeeping account, no matter how small your operation is. One thing that kind of bothers me, that if a tenant wishes to cause a landlord trouble, there's no way that the landlord can come out even, because if the tenant decides to stay and use up his security deposit as rent, there's no way that the landlord can get any further rent out of him, because he just says he hasn't got it. So then most of the time, like the lady says, the tenants will move out and leave the premises, you know, dirty, and it takes quite a little cleaning and cleaned up. Another item in the proposed legislation is the raising of rents. I don't know how you determine what a fair rental is. I know I have several rentals that I've built new, and the rental today is either the same or lower than it was at the time I built them. This has been over the last 10 years. Now, the taxes have gone up almost 100%. Sewer assessments are due, and insurance is raised, and all these things have cost the landlord more money, but due to competition, which I think is fair, we haven't been able to raise the rents. So I would like to have somebody tell me how you determine. Do you determine the rental on the amount of investment, or how do you determine what a fair rental is? I also feel that the law should state exactly how a person can get possession of a tenant's rental, you know, on non-payment of rent or for any other reason, as far as that goes. In the 16 years that I've been renting property, I've only had to evict one person, and that was not because of non-payment of rent, but because of the treatment of the property. Tenants as a whole, I'm sure, are as nice people as anybody we have to have. That's about it. Is there any questions? To be honest with you, this is probably a little bit true, because I've raised the deposits, because my largest deposit that I require is $100. I've never raised the deposit because I thought somebody, you know, looked like a bad risk or something. I've lowered them because the people were not unable to pay, or I felt that they was putting a strain on them.
Would you advocate allowing the landlord flexibility in setting the size of his own security deposit, or would you rather have it spelled out in the law exactly how much he can collect by way of a security deposit?
Yes, I say the landlord should be able to establish the amount of the security deposit, because some of them have expensive furniture, they have a lot of things that should determine the amount of money that they should charge.
Unrealistic sum, the renter will go elsewhere.
That's exactly right.
Okay. Again, the committee agrees with you as to the definition section of this bill, and it has been called to our attention that somebody is going to have to sit down and state in the definition section exactly how you determine or compute fair rental value. The definition section, we all concede, I believe, is deficient. We've got to define ordinary wear and tear. That's been a bunch of times. That would be too much for me.
Okay, thank you.
Should we hear it from the tenants now? Is there anybody from the other side of the fence who would like to be heard? Okay. Mrs. Wilson, Jackie Wilson. Or Mr. Jackie Wilson.
Betty Gordon, SMS Apartments. Most things have already been said, but I would like to stress this business of getting people out for different reasons. We have no specific time, and if we go through the courts, it takes an awfully long while. There are certain incidents, violence, other things happen in the apartments, and it would be nice if one could make the tenants leave right then, after they have committed these acts, but these are the very tenants that will defy you. Just won't let you into the apartment, will not leave the apartment, and the police don't do anything to help you on this. Also, there's a tremendous number do an awful lot of damage, and we have a very small security where at the SMS Apartments. But the thing is, even if you go to court and the court says, yes, these damages were committed and the tenant must pay, it then becomes the landlord's responsibility to actually collect. And if these tenants leave and you lose track of them, well, you don't get the money either. And it's very rare for them to garnish their wages toward either back rent or damages. And I think it would be very good if there was a set period and a small period for getting these people out, because it usually takes a month before you can rent the bad apartments when very bad damage has been done. I mean, they paint ceilings black with psychedelic scrawls, and I mean, it's a big job, and the $50 we charge security certainly doesn't cover it. And then their possessions. I've had people come to me 6 months after they've left. Actually, the Alaska Legal Service has called me because they've gone there and asked a lawyer for help. And sometimes we have them. We certainly don't throw away good things, and we store them until they do come for them. But there again, they don't want to pay a storage charge. Other people say they've left all their personal effects in there. And when we've checked, they do mean the clothes that are lying all over the floor. Very dirty. And we just think they've just left those, and the only place for them is the dumpster. It just depends on what they term valuable, I suppose. But we don't get an awful lot of help from the courts to get our money back. And that's about all.
By and large, can you live with this bill?
If you beg your pardon?
Can you live with this bill if we do not do it that which we say we're going to do?
Well,
to make it a better deal?
Yes, I think that if they are specific on this time limit and give us some way to get them out fast without going through the courts, this is it's an impossible situation the way it is now, because if you did lock someone out, a policeman will go with that tenant to the door without even checking with the office and tell them, it's all right, you can kick the door down, you are within your rights. And then it has turned out it isn't actually the tenant, it's the tenant's wife that's done this, but the police give them permission and stand by while they kick the door down before coming to the office, when we have never refused to let anyone in, even though their time is long up and everything else, we prefer them to collect their things. But as I say, we don't get an awful lot of cooperation from the people that can help you if they want to.
Just drink for a minute, which is not locking the door and, you know, until you get your guest. That is basically an abandoned concept in this day and age. People don't do it much anymore, and as you say, your police force ignores the law that's on the books.
Actually, the incident I'm referring to was when the tenant, as I knew it, the man, asked me to make sure nobody went in there while he was away. And yet the policeman stood by while the wife, because she was his wife, kicked in the door.
Well, there should be a lesson in that for all of us to interfere in a marital dispute. In the bill, Mrs. Gordon, let me ask a question if I may. There is a provision which says that a landlord shall have the right of access to the apartment for the purpose of showing it to another prospective tenant upon giving the right of access at reasonable times, upon the giving of 24 hours notice to the tenant. Do you find that to be unreasonable or not?
No, I think that would be reasonable. It actually doesn't affect me, because I wouldn't even dream of showing an apartment while there was someone in it. But, I mean, if they have given in their notice or they have to leave, then I think 24 hours is fair enough for them to go and leave.
And, of course, you concur that you have the right to go into the apartment in the case of emergency at any time.
Oh, yes, I think so. Well, they go from 125 to 255.
And you collect the same amount
on all? On all.
I'm going to depart from the norm now with the gentleman's consent. I'm taking him totally by surprise. I haven't even discussed this with him, but it's quite apparent that we have a superabundancy of landlords, which is why I don't object to that at all. But perhaps it might be educational for the landlords assembled to hear the other side of the coin, so to speak. This young man is with Alaska Legal Services in Juneau. He came up to Fairbanks to advise articulately on the bill. He stated some of his objections to the bill. Obviously, there are certain points in the bill where his opinion will be totally divergent from yours, but it is still a free country, and it might be educational for all of us. And if he were willing to come up and review briefly what he told us in Fairbanks the other day. His name is Don Clarkson. Don, may I pose a question to this examiner?
Well, you're right, I'm not prepared, but
sometimes you do a better job when they get you cold.
My name is Don Clarkson. I'm an attorney in the Juneau office of Alaska Legal Services. And I guess I should give a little bit of my background again, just briefly. Didn't seem to sit too well with people in Fairbanks, but I should say that I've only been in the state of Alaska for approximately 1 month. I will be the legislative liaison for Alaska Legal Services, which means I will be working on the landlord-tenant bill in the legislature. I participated in the drafting and the lobbying for the Washington State Residential Landlord-Tenant Act of 1973. That was approximately a 2 or 3 year process. And I also was involved in the negotiations with the national commissioners who, as Senator Ziegler has indicated, drafted a uniform Landlord-Tenant Act for proposed adoption in all of the 50 states. That bill basically was Senate Bill 54. And I hazard a guess that in my 1 month in Alaska, I have determined that as desirable as many of the provisions of that uniform bill are, they are not appropriate to Alaska. And I would have to agree with some of what Senator Ziegler has said, that changes are necessary. I think most of the changes have been made. Basically, my testimony in Fairbanks and here is that committee substitute to House Bill 226 as amended is a bill that we support with certain changes. And I'm not going to go through my entire testimony in Fairbanks, but I will hit on some of the highlights of that testimony because I felt that there were. I had located 19 things which I felt were essential to change. I'm not going to go through all of those. Some of those were simply typographical errors or at least things which were so obviously incorrect that hopefully they are not of dispute. And the part of this that's going to be difficult then is I'd like to respond a little bit to some of the testimony this morning, and I'm not quite prepared to do that, but we'll have a shot at it. Again, I'll skip around. On page 5, lines 17 and 18 of 226, which has already been discussed, I felt, based on my experience in the last 3 or 4 years, it's absolutely essential to provide some sort of definition of the term where resulting from ordinary use of the premises. In my experience, that was the largest dispute among landlords and tenants. We don't have a definition yet, and I expect to be able to submit something to the committee. I think that unless you provide a definition, to a large extent, the section on security deposits is not going to resolve the disputes. I also recommended on page 6, line 28, inserting an obligation of the landlord in those areas where there are local housing and health codes to comply with those codes. Perhaps my comments were misunderstood in Fairbanks, and I want to emphasize that that is not an attempt on my part, or our part, to bring a third party into the relationship between landlord and tenant. It's simply an attempt to provide a standard that is easily understandable. You are never or rarely going to get a landlord and tenant who are going to agree with certain types of defects, whether or not they exist. But if there is a third person or a third entity which has decided there is a defect, that is a standard that perhaps both of those parties can agree with. I think there ought to be an obligation to comply with those local codes, and I think the remedies that are provided in this act for tenants ought to be triggered at the point that there is a violation of the code and a refusal to repair. I agree with a great deal of the testimony already this morning. On page 16, line 17, dealing with the problems of abandonment, I may not agree with how to resolve the problem, but I think there is no question but that a definition of the term abandonment is necessary in order to provide guidelines. You have to keep in mind that primarily that section is designed for the benefit of landlords. In this state, as in Washington State and a great many other states, there is in the law now absolutely no standard about when a person is abandoned, when a landlord has a right to re-enter the property and take possession of the personal belongings, remove them, and re-rent the property. And every time that a landlord, under the present law, does re-enter the property, does remove those personal belongings and attempt to re-rent the property, they're very likely subjecting themselves to substantial tort liability, that is, substantial possibility of being sued by the tenant. And we don't want that. We want to provide some sort of standard. I suggest the standard should should be in the definition of abandonment, should be defined generally as an absence for a period of time. I'm afraid we have not yet agreed on that length of time. I think 3 days is much too short. But the definition, again, should be an absence, actual absence, for a period of time, and most importantly, a default in the payment of rent. Any person who is absent from the premises, who says they're going to be gone from the premises, albeit they don't say how long, and who is current in their rent, cannot, in any common sense of the word, be considered to have abandoned. And there should be no right to re-enter the property and re-rent it as long as the rent is paid. Now, we're talking about a non-judicial re-entry. That's why we're suggesting here that a landlord in this situation ought to have the chance to go in without going to court. And because I think that that's very dangerous, I think we have to provide a protection, and the protection is that they can't do it if the rent is paid. Just to give you an example of some of the detail that I went into that maybe is not important, on page 19, line 25, which provides for termination of the rental agreement upon 30 days' notice, I recommended inserting the word due between the word rental and the word date, simply because the term rental date is meaningless. And neither party can possibly understand what that means. If we're going to draft a statute, let's draft a statute that everybody can understand. Perhaps I can ask for some responses, or the committee can ask for some responses. I'm sorry. My experience has been, let's see, this is page 26, lines 4 through 9. The definition of a single-family residence. Those of you that have read the bill understand that the definition is important, because the standard of conduct for landlords is different if they're renting a single-family residence than if they're in a large multi-unit apartment building. The problem that I've seen come up in Washington, and I'm not yet aware, but assume that it is a problem in Alaska, is that under that definition, much of the new construction of apartment buildings is being constructed with generally independent facilities, independent hot water heaters, for example, independent heating facilities. So they have no connection with the unit next to them, even though they share a wall. And on the first floor of those apartment buildings, they open out onto the street, some of them, and not out onto a hallway. And that fits the definition of a single-family residence. So you have a situation under that definition where it is possible that the first floor of an apartment building will be considered, all of the units on the first floor will be considered a single-family residence, and the second, third, and fourth floors of that apartment building will be considered to be an apartment. And what your obligations are will depend on what floor you live on. And I think that's a little unreasonable, and I have suggested some modification of that definition. One item which has been discussed here extensively is the procedure by which a person can recover possession of the property. I would say, just in a brief response to those who have argued this morning that a landlord ought to have the right to unilaterally and arbitrarily terminate a rental agreement upon their belief that it's been violated, and to recover possession of the property without the assistance of a court, I would say to them that not only are there serious constitutional questions with that, but that it is in a very fundamental sense unfair. You may well have no dispute where the rent is in fact not paid, but under the proposals made today, that decision is left entirely in the hands of the landlord. And what happens if the landlord's wrong? What happens if there is a dispute, as there is so often, about whether or not, in fact, the rent was paid? Proposals given say that the landlord can decide unilaterally to remove the person from the property without any sort of review of whether the landlord is right or wrong. And I suggest that's not in any way fair. under our system of law. Now, to counter that, or to take the opposite side for a moment, I'd like to point out, as I pointed out to the committee, if I can find a citation. Thank you. Two places that the problem appears, on page 16, lines 2 and 3. This is a section for termination of the tenancy upon a non-payment of rent. And I just simply tell you that under that section, the way it's drafted now, the landlord has the obligation, in order to evict the tenant, to give a 14-day notice to pay rent or to move out. And at the end of that 14 days, must give another 30-day notice to pay rent or move out. Now, that's not obviously what the drafters intended. That's what the section says. The primary reason it says that is because of the language on lines 2 and 3, which says that at the end of that 14-day period, the landlord may terminate the tenancy. Well, the only section in here that provides for a way to terminate the tenancy is the 30-day notice section that we just referred to. So there's 14 days plus 30. I suggest not only is that unfair, because that's 34 days in a case where a person has not paid rent, or 44 days, but it's not what the drafters of the bill intended and needs to be rewritten. Another example of the same problem is on the final page of the bill, page 27. In the repealers, line 3, this is something that a lot of people don't look at. It's that part of the present law which is repealed because it's no longer necessary or no longer consistent with something that's in the bill. Well, if you read those repealers, as an attorney from Alaska Legal Services, I would be delighted to say that what you've repealed is all of the procedure giving the landlord any right whatsoever to remove a tenant by court action, by summary court action, that is. One thing that I think landlords have to keep in mind is that under the present law, they are in a very uniquely protected position in court, in that they have a summary, which means a fast legal proceeding to get the justice that they need. And it's a legal proceeding that is not granted in almost any other case in the law, that is the FED, or the Forcible Entry and Detainer Statute. What that means is that the law, the present law, already has very substantial remedy for quick action by a landlord. Now, a landlord doesn't use that, or a landlord's attorney, I may say, then that's the fault of the landlord's attorney, because the procedure is there. Now, again, with the drafting of this bill, there was an error made. That procedure has been repealed, and I suggested to the committee in Fairbanks that I would be redrafting that with the idea of granting to landlords as swift a judicial remedy as possible, still giving to the tenant's right to come in and say, I already paid the rent, I should not be evicted. You've got to give the tenant that opportunity. But you can also do it in a very quick proceeding. We might as well talk about repairing the duct. That happens to be a very great concern to most of my side. Repairing the duct has been deleted from this bill. And it is our position, I'm simply restating what I told the committee in Fairbanks, it is our position that the bill does not provide fair, adequate remedies for tenants unless there is a repairing the duct remedy. There is a repairing the duct remedy in the Washington statute. There are a great many states which have adopted a repair and deduct remedy. For those of you who don't know what it is, I can just briefly say that for minor defects, which are the obligation of the landlord, which the landlord refuses to fix, a repair and deduct remedy grants to the tenant the right to fix that item and to deduct the cost of that repair from the rent. Now, there's been a lot of automatic objection to that. I guess I can just simply speak from my experience in Washington that after a great deal of debate and a great deal of amendment and a great deal of rewriting what the uniform bill provided for repair of the duct. We were able to draft a statute that was acceptable to the landlords in Washington State. And I present that to you just so that you try to be aware of the fact that I think it can be drafted with sufficient protections that landlords need have no fear that their property is going to be taken away from them by a tenant that wishes to abuse that remedy. Unless you wish, I'm not going to go into the detail of the protections that I'm proposing, but I think it's sufficient to say that it would require a rewriting of the section, and I think that rewriting is very, very desirable and would create a fair bill.
Perhaps we'll ask for your